Okay.
I'm sorry?
Can you all hear me? Excellent. Well, welcome to Developing Clean and Efficient Alternative Energy Strategies. That's what we're going to be discussing here. And my name is Mason Wilrich, and I'm a trustee of this worthy organization, the World Affairs Council. Hope you're enjoying the program so far. I also am the chairman of the board of the California Independent System Operator. We operate the electric transmission grid for the state of California, and I'm an advisor to a major research project at MIT that's focused on accelerating energy innovation in our systems. The format is going to be that we're going to have short presentations from our panel members, and then we will have questions and answers. And if you write down your questions, that's good. I had a little discussion with management, and it's helpful if you do that, because they are recording the proceedings, and so the question can come through and get recorded well for that purpose. However, if there's, I will feel free as moderator if there's some need for just getting the audience getting in and interacting in a less formal way. I'm going to overrule the system in light of seizing the debate of the moment. So I thought that the Amory's keynote and Jane and David's and Dan's plenary really set the table beautifully for what we're going to be spending our time on. I come away with the notions, just a couple of words pull it up for us again. In terms of energy, you have the economy, you have environment, and you have security. And I liked Dan's triangle a lot in terms of technology, policy, and finance. And I'm just pleased very much that we have three expert panelists that can address this subject, and we can get in much deeper than we did with the plenary that set the stage. So I'm going to introduce all three, and then we can go rapidly through presentations by each of them of about 10 minutes, and then questions and answers. So Jan Hamrin, she is Chief Executive Officer of HMW International. That's her consulting firm focused on renewable energy. And before that, she was the president of the Center for Resource Solutions, which was based in the Presidio and doing a lot of good work over a number of years. I first came to know Jan when she was the executive director of the Independent Energy Producers of California, which led in the first wave of what was then qualifying facilities coming on stream inside the state of California, major contribution. Jan has a PhD in ecology from UC Davis. Second speaker will be Neil Renninger, co-founder and chief technology officer of Amyris Biotechnologies, which is a Bay Area biotech energy, bioenergy firm. And I read about him and his firm in a wonderful write-up in Fred Krupp's, the president of Environmental Defense Fund, his book, Earth, the Sequel, and it was a wonderful story. And any of you that want to understand the dynamics that they've been through to get to where they're going, I'd encourage you to read that. Neil has a graduated from MIT. I was happy to see that. And also UC Berkeley with a PhD in chemical engineering. And so he's the second speaker. And then anchoring the speakers will be James Woolsey. And he has served in four administrations, two Republican and two Democrat, as a presidential appointee. You may recall him as being the President Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence. He also is currently a partner in Vantage Point Venture Fund, which is focused at, and he's specializing in their clean tech sector. He has published a lot of very interesting pieces in various magazines over time about the biofuels industry in particular. Jim is a locally educated Stanford BA. And then a Rhodes Scholar, and finished with a LLB from Yale University. So, with those as introductions, Jan, over to you.
Thank you. Is that working? I really appreciate being here and appreciate the invitation, and hope that some of the things that we say will stimulate you to a lot of questions and a good back and forth between the audience and the people up here at the table. I've known Amory for a long time, and at the end of his presentation this morning, the temptation is always to say, well, it sounds like everything's under control, so I guess we don't need to do anything. I mean, it's all just happening. Unfortunately, that's not the case. And as several of the people on the next panel pointed out, and I would like to emphasize further, our problems are institutional rather than technical. Our problems are human rather than inanimate objects. This morning I'd like to talk about three things. One, vision. Second, the role of government and institutions. And the third, building bridges. We can't make something happen if we can't visualize it. And this is one of the problems that we have, that change is hard. As humans, we really don't like change. We are very comfortable doing what we've always done. And as much as we might talk about change, it still is not the thing that comes automatically to the forefront. Certainly, if you look into the economic crisis and providing money, bailout money, and then seeing banks and other institutions continuing to do business as usual, that even though somebody said, no, this can't be business as usual, we have to change, it's not because people are evil or anything of that nature. It's that it's really hard to change. And so there's a tendency to still want to keep doing things the way we've been doing things. And that is true of all of our institutions, but we're at a point where we really need to make major changes. So part of the way that our institutions, particularly our public institutions, come up with policies and programs and so forth is they look at scenarios that are often done by large international organizations like the International Energy Agency. The International Energy Agency does scenarios of what the energy sector, what the electricity sector is going to look like over the next 20, 30, 40 years. When you look at those scenarios, you find they start with assumptions that everything's going to be like today, only more. They start with assumptions of where we are now, what the policies are that we have now, and project those out into the future. So you end up with scenarios that don't really make big changes and that make you feel as though the future, that we have limited options. It's because we are using old tools and we are not building in innovation and flexibility, the things that we need to have in order to meet the challenges that are in front of us. The role of government, I think, a big role of government, is to represent the public's interest in the long term as well as the short term. And much of the conflict that we have is between short-term gains and the long-term changes that need to happen. We have essentially a failure of our institutions because our institutions are not good at dealing with innovation. They aren't good at dealing with disruptive technologies. And many of the technologies, certainly most of them that Amory was talking about and many of them that the other panel was were talking about, are disruptive technologies. They are not, you can't put them in place and have all the infrastructure and everything else around it be business as usual. You have to really be able to change. So one of the things that I suggest we need to do is plan for success. And it sounds funny, but it's not the way we go about doing things. Generally, we say, well, what would we need to have distributed photovoltaics on all the rooftops or any place that we wanted? And then we start a debate about, but it's too expensive, and we can't do this and we can't do that. And we don't really think about, what if we were wildly successful? What if photovoltaics were actually less than a dollar a peak watt, 50 cents a peak watt, 25 cents a peak watt? Then what would the problem be? What would we do? How would we use them? Are there other things that could stand in the way? Would we have enough installers who could put them, install them, enough people that are trained? Could the distribution system actually handle power generation units all over the urban landscape? It's not designed for that. Are there real technical issues, or are they more likely to be artificial issues? We need to think about things and pretend as though we all really cared. What if we really wanted to do these things? What would we do? Not how can we stop it because it's not the way I do business and I can't make money out of it. So I just want a few more years of doing business the way I've always done it to make my money, and then I'll let somebody else worry about it. But if instead we actually try to visualize a future with zero emissions from our electricity sector, if we want electric vehicles as being part of the solution, we don't want that electricity to be coming from coal plants or fossil plants. So what are the things that need to be put into place in order to make to be really successful at the kinds of things that we want to have? I think most, I wouldn't do this in most meetings, but in this particular meeting, everybody in this room just about can remember 40 years ago. You can remember 1970. That wasn't that long ago. Well, 2050 is about the same distance in the future. That's a lot of work to do in a short amount of time. We talk about 2030 and some of these targets and technologies and how important they are for 2030. But 1990 wasn't that long ago. And that's about the same amount of time in the past as we have in the future to make these changes. So what we need to do is, I think, look at bridges, the bridges we need to build in order to bring these technologies in order to achieve the kind of changes we want. Zero emitting electricity sector, zero emitting housing, zero-emitting transportation. So where might we make investments? Well, certainly infrastructure and job training are critical in order to get where you want to go. And I think the administration has that in mind and is putting those concepts into place and putting stimulus money in there. Programs and policies that help low-income and middle-income households are absolutely critical in order to get where we want to go. I can afford to put a photovoltaic system on my roof, and I have one on my roof, but not everybody can do that. I can afford to have a house that has the latest in energy-efficient windows and insulation and appliances, but not everyone can afford to do that. So finding ways of bringing all parts of the economy in are critical. And the bridge technologies, I think, in power generation, to wrap up, that local is important. Local renewable energy manufacturing. So we're not importing everything, and so we're not hauling large pieces of equipment all around the countryside and using lots of fuels to transport. Grid-connected renewable energy projects, private-public partnerships with water, waste management districts, with water districts, with all of our infrastructure areas that desperately need and want to reduce their energy consumption and can be part of the solution. Behind-the-meter technologies, on-site technologies that we can have at our homes and offices and industries. Packages and installers of technologies. I don't want to go out and have to figure out which panel is best and which installer and which inverter and which whatever. I want to be able to just get a package that can go onto my house. Batteries. If you're going to invest anywhere, we need batteries for transportation. We need batteries in many of the distributed generation. And we need to move forward in housing and remember that the houses that we build today are going to last. Hopefully they last 100 years. They'll at least last 50 years. So though we look at how we can refit the housing and the buildings we have, we also have to stop now building buildings and housing that are highly inefficient in the way that energy is used. I think that I want to end by talking just briefly summing up some of the institutional problems. One is electric utility. Electric utility makes its money from capital investments and from selling energy. And even though in theory we have decoupled the energy efficiency in policy-wise for electric utilities, an electric utility will still make 11-point-something guaranteed return on profit for building power plants. It is as long as they are going to have that incentive to continue building large power plants and not necessarily, in fact, have a disincentive for energy savings and for distributed generation. Again, not because they're evil, not because they don't want to help us where we want to go, but because we have an old regulatory system, we have old tools, and we have old incentives that are putting us in the wrong places. So I think all of these areas, we need to look at our institutions. We need to do what we can to make sure the incentives send us in the right directions to support the kinds of technologies and changes that we need. Thank you.
Very good. That's a great start. And now, Neil Reininger, up to you.
Great. Thanks. Thank you very much to the organizers for having me out. Very excited to tell you a little bit about Amyris and what we're doing, and as well as how we're looking at the world of renewable energy. Just a little bit of context, my background. As Mason mentioned, I'm co-founder and CTO of Amyris. We're a 200-person company in Emeryville, California. We initially developed technology around the production of an anti-malarial compound, a compound called artemisinin, work that we worked on with the Institute for One World Health in the city here, as well as UC Berkeley, funded by the Gates Foundation. And interestingly enough, we're using that same technology to produce a suite of biofuels now. The most prominent biofuels, as everyone knows, is ethanol, and ethanol has gotten a bit of a bad rap, I think, because of its relationship with corn. In reality, ethanol is a very good biofuel, very sustainable if it's made from the right feedstock. That said, has some limitations. It doesn't look, feel, act like our normal petroleum-based fuels. It's just not the same. So it leads to some problems with transportability and materials compatibility and the way that ethanol is dealt with in the world. At Amyris, we're taking the same yeast that's been used for thousands of years to turn sugar into ethanol, and we're modifying that yeast. We're taking it, engineering it, reprogramming it, so that it makes a suite of hydrocarbon fuels, things that look like our traditional fuels, but they're just made from different feedstock. Instead of coming from petroleum, we use sugar. So you end up with all of the greenhouse gas benefits of sugarcane ethanol with none of the trade-offs, no compromises. We pick individual molecules that are fit for purpose for gasoline or diesel or jet fuel, and that way not only do we reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but we also reduce tailpipe and exhaust emissions. Which leads me to my first point, and that's, well, I think we have a fantastic solution in the world of biofuels. It's just a single solution to a single problem that we have in front of us as a society. I think a great framework to start with is work coming out of the Carbon Mitigation Institute in Princeton. This is a concept of carbon stabilization wedges. In order to maintain today's carbon dioxide emission levels, greenhouse gas emission levels, we need to remove seven carbon wedges. Each wedge is about 25 gigatons of carbon emissions over the next 50 years. And we can do so through the implementation of new or sometimes existing technologies. Renewable fuels, say the authors, is just one of those potential wedges. Now, I'd argue maybe it's more than one, but it's certainly not seven. So we need solutions across the board: efficiency, carbon capture, sequestration, sustainable agriculture, renewable electricity, new vehicle technologies, potentially nuclear power to really make an impact. Which leads me to my second point, and that's it's not really a question of what specific technologies we should be investing in my mind. It's how we should focus on the problem as a whole, and how we should be looking at the different opportunities. And it's really different in different sectors. Electricity is difficult to transport. We don't have a good way of storing it. We don't have a good way of taking electrons produced in South America and moving them to Europe. So we do need local solutions. You look at the liquid transportation infrastructure, and it's quite different. And I'd argue that local solutions perhaps may not be as necessary in the liquid transportation fuels infrastructure. We transport fuels around the world all the time. Fuel that we burn can come from petroleum that was derived from the Gulf of Mexico and refined in Houston, or it could come from a product that was oil that was derived from the Middle East and refined somewhere in Europe. So the distribution infrastructure exists. The trick really is to find solutions that work well within that infrastructure, that work within the distribution infrastructure that exists, that work in today's engines, that really fuels that resemble things that are used today, which leads to reduced amount of investment required, lower amounts of capital required. We don't need tens of billions of dollars for new pipelines, new cars, new pumps. And because of that, we can increase the demand for the biofuels we make and increase the impact that they'll have. This also allows us to look at production more globally. Hydrocarbons, to me, the future hydrocarbon liquid transportation fuel, actually more generally, liquid transportation fuel suite of fuels includes hydrocarbons that are produced from sugarcane in Brazil, mixed with hydrocarbons that are produced from petroleum from the Middle East, mixed with hydrocarbons produced by the gasification of biomass in Europe, mixed with hydrocarbons produced by fermentation of cellulosic biomass in the United States. So it really leads to the question of where can we optimally produce the liquid transportation fuels that that we need. As I said, the same can't necessarily be said for electrons and the production and distribution of electrons. We don't have the technologies at this point for the storage of those electrons and the movement of those electrons economically reasonable way. And the distribution systems don't necessarily exist, robust distribution systems don't necessarily exist yet. We need to spend money on infrastructure to be able to move electrons from wind power generated in Wyoming to the West Coast or even to Denver. As I said, an adequate distribution infrastructure exists for liquid fuels, but doesn't necessarily exist for electrons. So in power generation, we need technology development and infrastructure investment. You know, as an aside, people often ask me and ask people in our industry, you know, what do we think of electric vehicles? Does that mean we don't believe in electric vehicles? And the answer is absolutely, well, I absolutely believe in electric vehicles. I think they're incredibly important. I'd love to be able to take an electric car and use it for my commute every day, and I think that's the way we should be going. The economy is run on diesel. The commerce is run on diesel. Trucks and trains are run on diesel fuel. A couple hundred miles of vehicle range just is irrelevant for moving goods from the coast to the Midwest or from the middle of the country to the coast. So really, we need a combination of solutions. And it's also interesting to think about electric cars and when they're charged. Generally, we think of electric cars charged at home and electrons generated at night aren't necessarily carbon, low-carbon electrons. The low-carbon electrons, the wind power and solar power is really generated during the day. So, you know, we need to develop technologies that generate low-carbon electrons or are able to store low-carbon electrons that are generated during the day so that we can use them at different parts of the day. So, again, we need a combination of solutions. To close, we have to think about what courses of action we should take. Well, first, we need to continue to fund R&D, demonstration projects and deployment as well. The incumbents, fossil fuels, generally have had decades of such funding, and we need the same sort of funding in renewables. Second, we need to look at pricing in the externality of greenhouse gas emissions, whether that's through a carbon tax or more likely a carbon cap and trade. We need to be able to price that in so that we as a society can start making the right decisions and baking in the cost of production of what we're throwing away, the carbon dioxide, into the price of the fuels. On top of that, the credits and subsidies that we need need to be stable. You know, the wind power industry the growth of the wind industry is really stunted for quite a few years because of gaps in the production tax credit that existed. That gap has disappeared over the past couple of years, and you've seen a big growth in the wind industry. We need stable subsidies or credits. And then third, we need, I think, a thoughtful debate on how we're looking at the use of land and whether it makes sense to take an acre of cropland in the United States and produce a certain amount of fuel when we could take that same acre of land somewhere in the middle of rural Brazil and produce three times the amount of energy. We need to have that debate and talk about whether it makes sense from an economic standpoint, whether it makes sense from an environmental standpoint, whether it makes sense from an energy security standpoint.
Thank you very much, Neil. Jim?
Thanks, Mason. Well, it's an honor to be here this morning, but to have been invited. But to tell you the truth, since I spent 22 years as a Washington lawyer and then some time out at the CIA in the Clinton administration, I'm actually honored to be invited into any polite company for any purpose at all. I think it's clear we're trying to do three things with energy. We're trying to have it be clean, particularly these days in CO2 terms. We need it to be secure. We need to have it when we need it and not have other people control it. We need it to be affordable. We can't neglect any of those three or we're not doing our job. Now, within the energy world, we have two big energy systems in the United States, that which powers transportation and that which powers electricity generation. Transportation is 97% petroleum-based, and that petroleum is monopolized by OPEC and one or two other non-OPEC big producers like Russia, something like three-quarters monopolized. And there are some problems with that, quite apart from climate change. In his new book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded, Tom Friedman has a wonderful chapter called Fill Her Up with Dictators. It's exactly right. The huge amount of economic rent associated with a commodity like oil, even at $40 to $50 a barrel, but certainly at $140 a barrel, tends in non-democracies to concentrate power further and further in the hands of an autocratic state. Paul Collier, professor at Oxford, has written extensively on this. It's really a reasonably straightforward phenomenon. And it's the reason why 8 of the 9 largest oil exporters in the world are dictatorships or autocratic kingdoms. Only nice Norway is kind of out of place there because of geology. But we have a problem with that. It is sometimes understated out of politeness to some of our sometime allies in the Middle East and elsewhere, but it should not be understated. Just to give you one idea, Iran clearly has a nuclear weapons program in train. They have enough light-enriched uranium to turn it into highly enriched uranium within probably a matter of a few months to a few years to have a nuclear weapon. Recently, you have seen Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the UAE all express great interest in moving toward nuclear power. Do you think it's because the Middle East doesn't have enough oil and gas to generate electricity? I don't think so. I think it has something to do with a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, fueled by oil, and the autocratic nature of the states, fueled by oil. There are other examples, but the problem I would submit is oil, not foreign oil, oil. And it's a problem because of climate change And it's a problem because of the filler-up with dictators problem. And the only way to deal with it is to do to oil what was done to salt in the 1890s and the beginning of the 20th century. Annie Corin has come up with this analogy. I think it's a very good one. For millennia before the end of the 19th century, salt was a strategic commodity. It was the only way to preserve meat. Meat was a hugely important part of the human food chain. Salt mines mattered. Countries that had salt mines lorded it over other countries. Countries went to war over salt mines. Beginning in the late 1890s and early 20th century, the coming of the electricity grid and refrigeration and freezing within a relatively few years destroyed salt as a strategic commodity. Salt became boring, a boring, useful commodity in international trade. You'll have it on the lunch table. Will you know where it came from? Are we salt independent? Do you care? Does anybody care? Of course not. Not unless you're Long and Mortons. It just doesn't matter. All right? We need to do that with oil. Right? Second point. The electricity generation side of our energy picture uses now almost no oil in the U.S., 4 or 5% worldwide, in the U.S., 2%. Our electricity is 51% from coal, about 20% from nuclear, about 20% from gas, most of the rest from hydro, and a little bit of renewables, 2% from oil. So today, prior to the electrification of transportation, if someone says to you they're going to put in a wind farm or they're going to build a nuclear power plant and thereby reduce our reliance on foreign oil, how correct are they? They are 2% correct. They are dealing with 2% of the problem, but they are not dealing with the fundamental problem. I would submit that in order to move away from oil and to move at the same time to clean electricity, we need to have some policies, which is what this panel is really to focus on, that will move us toward both electrification and the use of alternative second and third generation, particularly biofuels, for transportation. Now, I had my, and furthermore, we need to do it with transportation mechanisms and systems in which we don't need new infrastructure, or if we need any changes to infrastructure, they're very small, or we need no new infrastructure at all. A123 in Boston has converted my Prius to be a plug-in. I have an extra 5 kilowatt-hour battery in the back where the spare tire goes. I charge it in California, in San Francisco, for 8 cents a kilowatt-hour at night, 40 cents for the night. Drive about 40 miles, essentially all electric, the next day, a little over a penny a mile. At the end of that time, unfortunately, I have to start to use gasoline, and since it's a Prius, I get about 45 miles to the gallon. If what I had in my tank was even today's E85, 85% ethanol, but better still, if it were, say, butanol a few years from now, which is much friendlier in terms of infrastructure than ethanol, I could be driving at, instead of for the first 40 miles, 150 miles a gallon or so, which is what I'm getting now, I could be driving at hundreds and hundreds of miles per gallon because I'd be driving either on electricity or on the biofuels in some mixture. Now, aren't we going to create a problem if we electrify transportation? Not if we do it right. First of all, studies by the Natural Resources Defense Council, by EPRI, the Electric Power Research Institute, the utilities, and by Pacific Northwest National Laboratories, DOE lab, all three say the same thing. Today, take an internal combustion engine, get rid of it, go with a plug-in hybrid, just make that swap, and average in the country as a whole, even though the grid is 51% coal, you are improving your global warming gas emissions by about 20%, and in a clean grid state like California, you're improving at 80 to 90%. Further, as the grid cleans up more and more, the cars clean up. That doesn't happen unless you go to electrification of transportation. So again, a combination via plug-in hybrids of electrification and advanced biofuels seems to me to be a very potentially positive way to go. Now, how can we implement that? One thing we have to realize is that a cap-and-trade system, valuable as it is for electricity, has a very modest effect on transportation economics. A dollar a ton of carbon dioxide in a cap-and-trade system is about a penny a gallon at the pump. So if you have a $30 a ton price of CO2 in a cap-and-trade type system, you've only increased the cost of gasoline by about 30 cents. There are other institutional mechanisms that are worth looking at. Charles Krauthammer and Senator Richard Lugar have proposed a dollar a gallon tax on gasoline that is 100% rebated to the public via unemployment compensation increases, Social Security increases, and reductions in FICA taxes. So there are ways to go at this kind of transition. But the interesting thing is that electricity is enough cheaper than gasoline, about a factor of 4 or 5, even with existing oil prices, that there is a major incentive to move toward electricity even without the gasoline tax increase. With respect to electricity, it's important, I think, to realize that with a renewable portfolio standard, you have a long-term incentive for utilities to move toward renewables, and that's a good thing. And insofar as you have a carbon cap and trade system, you have a long-term incentive for them to move away from carbon-emitting sources like coal, and that's a good thing. But these are long-term incentives, and they tend to create incentives only for large power plants. What, if you look at a country, and most European countries have now followed Germany, but Germany has a system called a feed-in tariff, which is only beginning to be considered in various parts of the United States, that encourages moving toward renewables for electricity for small and medium-sized producers. It has been phenomenally successful. There's more solar on one building, admittedly it's a big building, in Germany than in the entire state of Florida, 2 megawatts. Germany has 6 times the solar of the United States, largest solar deployments in the world. A third of them are on barns, farmers' barns. It's because of the encouragement of this system. And by the way, Germany's average climate is about that of Juneau, Alaska. So we're not talking the Sunshine State here. We can, by moving toward things like feed-in tariffs to guarantee prices for renewables, we can give a substantial incentive toward moving toward renewables. And we'll close with this point. We need to move toward renewables in a way that is compatible with the interests of the developing world. We, each of us Americans, creates average about 20 tons of carbon a year. World average is about 4. The bottom couple of billion people in poverty in the world, it's about 1 ton of carbon for them. We cannot, in the interests of the planet, have them move into prosperity by burning more and more fossil fuels the way we have for the last couple of centuries. They need to jump over that in a sort of like many of them jumped over landline telephones by going immediately to cell phones. And the technologies that will help with that, distributed generation, cogeneration, some of the things Amory was talking about, small scale, I think, wind, and especially photovoltaics, and the pressures to move forward decisively in order to lower the cost of things like photovoltaics so that you can have them on the rooftops of African villages as well as in Marin County, is, I think, our major challenge and a major and important mission. It's one that we have a reasonable chance of accomplishing if we stay focused. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim. All right, we've got a lot of good statements before our audience, and I've also got a lot of really good questions from the audience. So let me begin with one that I think it was to start with you, but what I'd like to do is to maybe start with somebody and then everybody chime in here. Can you comment on the interactions, relationships between energy and water use, especially in developing countries such as China? And I guess I would add in that developing country that's we're immersed in California?
Well, I'll start briefly. I've worked in China for the last 11 years on renewable energy policy. And one of the things that you see in every country is that we take care of water here, we take care of electricity here, we take care of medical facilities here. Everything's compartmentalized. And very seldom do those governmental entities work together. China has major problems with water. The groundwater, the water table continues to drop precipitously. There are major rivers in China that no longer reach the ocean during certain months of the year. Power plants, traditional centralized power plants, require huge amounts of water. They require water for cooling. They require water for washing the coal, if you're doing coal plants, things of that nature. The two are really closely intertwined. And in addition, as was mentioned this morning, the water we use domestically and here in California requires tremendous amount of electricity to pump it around. And we use it very inefficiently. As Amory mentioned, we have systems that have great friction in them that require more pumping than should be necessary for the water. So there's direct links between water and electricity. And then finally, as we move forward in the future and have greater demands for potable water simply because of greater population, we are going to be looking at alternatives for cleaning up water, with desalination being one of those possibilities. And as a friend once told me, you know, a hydroelectric plant is like taking, you take large amounts of water and you turn it into electricity and money to some extent. With desalination, we take large amounts of money and we turn, and large amounts of electricity and we turn it into water. So there's interesting nexus there and something we definitely need to work on.
Okay, do you want to?
There's also obviously a tie between biofuel production and water use, water use to grow the crops, water use in the production process itself, and as we look at biofuel crops going into the future, we need to focus ourselves on crops that are low water using, low fertilizer using processes that are low water using, and I think that's has been a focus of a lot of the crop engineering companies in the United States and around the world, and is a place of a great amount of development.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Next question, and I will pass it on to you to start, Jim. And this is one of my favorites of all favorites. There is a huge gap between our potential energy savings and solutions and what's happening in the real world. That gap is documented by everybody who looks at it, including the one that McKinsey has done, and where you see below the line is all energy efficiency. How can we bridge that gap? So why don't we start with Jim and we'll work across solutions.
Amory, I got here late this morning, so I don't know if he said it this morning, but I've heard him other times talk about freeing up the flow of the chi in the institutions by doing institutional acupuncture. And it's a wonderful image because the flow really is very congested. The incentive structure in these institutions is very, very old. We are essentially dealing with restructuring three of the four or five largest industries on the planet, automotive, electricity, and oil and gas. And all three are basically pretty happy operating on their 19th century business plans. they're doing essentially what they were doing in the 1890s, all three of them, just with more modern technology. And in order to get a utility in the United States and a public utility commission to permit private wires, as they're called, a factory that produces a lot of waste heat, uses it in Denmark to turn a generator, strings a wire across the road, the factory across the road that needs electricity uses it, both do a lot better. A third of the electricity in Denmark is at cogeneration or combined heat and power, and it's about 4% in the United States. And the reason is that there are a lot of laws against it. The utilities know how to build their own power plants and run them, and that's the way they like to continue to do them. It's not a safety issue, not if you do it right. It's a change in the flow of the institutional chi issue. And one really, really needs to go after these changes and endorse them where they occur. I mean, I wish it had come sooner, but Bob Lutz, who will step down, I guess, toward the end of this year as vice chairman of General Motors, has been in the car business for 50 years, and for 50 years it's always been to him, build them bigger, build them faster. And then a couple of years ago, he started saying, yeah, we want to build the kind of cars you want, and we want them to be big when you want them big and fast when you want them fast, but we're going to run them on something other than petroleum products. They're going to be run on biofuels, electricity, or some combination. Now, bless him, but I wish that change had come to Detroit 20, 30 years ago. So those kinds of institutional changes in attitude are really important. Each one is kind of a struggle. Decoupling, as Jan talked about, doesn't solve all the problems. It's a step. But these three big industries and the regulatory and tax mechanisms for them all need thorough overhauls. And it's sometimes like pulling teeth.
I just want to second that and say that part of it, I think, will require maybe new people, younger people, who really want to make the change, especially with energy efficiency, who aren't just giving lip service to it, not just doing it because they're being beaten up by the regulator if they don't, but who actually say, what if we really tried to do this? How could we do it better? And I think there also needs to be more and closer relationships with local governments so that local government policies are going in the same direction that we want for our larger policies, for our larger institutions.
See, I've got one for you, Neil, if you'd entertain it. What is the role of algae in our energy future?
Great question. I think you have to look at the different solutions that we have available to us, and realize that we need not only a distributed set of solutions to different problems, but also a distribution of solutions to problems at different that they may have different times for development. I think the potential for algae is great. It's fantastic. The challenge for algae production of fuels is immense. There's a lot of money going into algae right now, I think I don't feel it's very likely that we'll see production of algal-based biofuels for the next decade. Does it mean that we shouldn't be investing in it? Absolutely not. We should. But to think that we're going to be able to see algal-based biofuels in the next few years at prices competitive with petroleum-based fuels. The technology has a lot of development to do.
Yeah. Mason, via Vantage Point, I'm a chairman of Strategic Advisory Council for Solazyme, which is a local algae company here in South San Francisco. And the thing to remember about algae is that there's lots of kinds of algae. And most of the companies that are working today on it are using algae that does photosynthesis and floats on the surface and so forth. But there are other things that happen. There are algae that eat things in the ocean down in the cracks, and the very grungy algae, let's call them. There's macroalgae, otherwise known as seaweed, as well as microalgae. The interaction between all of these processes is just beginning to be understood. But I'm not as pessimistic as Neil about how fast things may go. And I do think that the possibility of getting some extraordinary efficiencies in the use of land and resources without facing some of the problems of yield per acre and all of that that has come to the fore on other biofuels is there. I would say in the biofuels area, it's algae are one of the two or three main things to keep your eye on.
Okay. So this is changing the kind of question, and I think it's really needs addressing by the panel. If we depend on government and regulations for incentives, how do we create the long-term stable environment for private sector investment? Jim, you want to start?
Well, anybody who thinks that there's a free market in, say, oil today needs to rethink his or her position. Not only is there the depletion allowance and the intangible drilling costs and all of that, billions of dollars a year, I might add considerably more than the billions of dollars a year subsidies to ethanol. But there are phenomena such as this. Boyden Gray, former counsel to first President Bush and second President Bush's ambassador to the EU, very distinguished lawyer in Washington, wrote an article 3 years ago, hadn't gotten nearly the attention that it deserves, about aromatics. Aromatics, in spite of their name, are ugly things, xylene, toluene, components of gasoline that are left in after the refining process in order to basically pick up the performance of the vehicles to add octane. Unfortunately, they are extremely carcinogenic. They're highly regulated when they're put out by anything else, like a chemical plant. They are very dangerous to the health of Americans, and oil has had a waiver from the beginning of the Clean Air Act, year after year after year, to permit it to continue to pour carcinogens into the atmosphere because they make more money that way. Well, someone needs to start calculating the negative health effects of putting aromatics into the exhausts of vehicles and figure out how we can take that what is now an externality and figure out how we can, I think, make oil pay for it. That would not, from my point of view, be a government intervention into the system. That would be stopping giving oil a break that other industries don't have, a waiver that they don't have. So if one wants to go absolutely cold turkey, nobody gets any subsidies of any kind at all, nuclear doesn't get insurance from the federal government, people who need transmission lines don't get federal tax money in any way to help them build those transmission lines, everything goes on its own, I think you would find that distributed generation and some types of biofuels would do extremely well. We might well look at going to an absolutely zero subsidized energy sector, and then you will find that coal, fossil fuels, big transmission lines, and the rest are getting an awful lot of money from the federal government.
Anybody else?
Just out of that, I think all of the companies in the biofuel sector, while we all need subsidies in order to get started, while they're very important for our businesses in order to build production, all of us don't want to rely on subsidies for the long term. We all have business plans that don't rely on 50 cents a gallon, dollar a gallon type tax credits. Now, that said, as Jim said, I think it's important that we price in all the externalities, price in the carbon emissions, price in, as Jim said, some of the other externalities in terms of evaporative emissions that come along with petroleum-based fuels. But to think that we will be reliant on subsidies for a long period of time, I think that that's just not the way we're operating.
Yeah. I agree, but it's more difficult. Taking away a subsidy is really hard. We need to do smart subsidies or smart policies with the ones we're designing today. But in the electricity sector, there's no free market. There never has been, and there won't be because it's considered a public good. And in order to bring innovation and innovative technologies into a completely regulated sector requires a lot of work because that sector is going to tend to protect the status quo, the folks that already have a market share, and it's going to fight against anybody coming in with a new technology or new innovation. So it will require government intervention in some respect in order to bring this around. At the same time, from the point of view of any kind of incentives, financial incentives that are part of that, they should be built in a way that they phase out and that the industry itself knows it will phase out. Not a surprise, this year we're canceling them kind of thing, but you get this level this year and this level next year and this level the next year, and so that the private sector can plan for, can use the incentives when they're there, can bring down the cost of these technologies, and that we can have a reasonable phase out rather than a boom and bust kind of thing that we've tended to have with many of our policies.
I'm tempted to just make a slight comment myself on this, one of the fascinating issues I see is that to really grasp the energy systems that we have and then go to scale with innovation when you've got these large incumbent infrastructures that can defend themselves pretty well. But to do that on scale, and then you get back to starting with some subsidies and corrections to the market, trying to make the prices incorporate externalities and so forth. But just achieving those scale changes in the time frame in which we need, if climate change is what scientific community seems to be converging on, that seems to me that is it's a quantum change in terms of how we approach innovation in our society. So back to asking questions, which is my role on behalf of you. What is necessary to, and this is getting back to a minor tweak, but what is necessary to have decoupling? Now, we know from Amory's talk to us and so forth what decoupling is, where the utility does not make money on the amount of electricity it sells, but rather on the amount of money for the shareholders is not dependent on sales. So what's necessary to have a little modest tweak for our utilities for all 50 states.
Well, I'll just add one thing. I mentioned a feed-in tariff briefly. If you want small and medium-sized entities, farms, small businesses, retirement homes, individual residences, shopping centers, to go toward generating renewables, electricity from renewables, it has to be profitable for them. And there are two ways you can get at this. One is the way Berkeley, California, did, which was to provide the money up front, or at least a substantial share of it, for something like solar panels on a house, and then the individual has his property taxes augmented slightly in order to pay for that. Now, cities and towns and states are out of money these days, and so that's a problem. So you may think that one good idea would be for the federal government to come in and have programs as part of the packages that are being funded now to help other Berkeley and other cities and states do that. Either that or a feed-in tariff, and a feed-in tariff is just a requirement for the utility to purchase renewable energy that's generated by an individual home or a small business for 20 years at a fixed price, which lets the individual take that contract to a bank, and even in these days and times, get two-thirds or three-quarters of the money loaned for him to install the solar on his roof. You need steps like that, either a feed-in tariff or like what Berkeley did or Berkeley augmented by the federal government, to move toward having solar, let's say, spread widely in society. What happens now with a renewable portfolio standard is it's as if we all decided and the state of California decided that by 2020, 20% of our fruits and vegetables that we ate had to be organic, okay? And they put that requirement on grocery stores. And the grocery store said, okay, in 11 years we have to be selling 20% organic vegetables, and lots of folks out in farmers and people with gardens in their backyard said, great, and they get their organic fruits and vegetables, and they go to the grocery store and they say, would you buy these from us, and then go ahead and sell them. And the grocery store says, you guys are too much trouble to deal with. We don't want to have to deal with all these individual pickup trucks and people with baskets and stuff like that. Go away. We're going to deal with big wholesalers and nobody else. That's basically what the utilities do with respect to things like renewables. If you want regular folks, regular businesses and so forth to get into the renewables business and be able to make money at it, you have to either do what Berkeley did or you have to have something like a feed-in tariff.
Okay, I'm going to, we're getting into a time warp here, and I've got some very good questions. So do you want to do the comment on decoupling? I sense you might.
I'm not an expert.
Decoupling for 50 states.
For energy efficiency, it's okay. Really difficult to do that. And I don't know that we have enough time here to really handle it adequately. So I apologize because it is important, but it's a...
Well,
overwhelming question.
What's interesting is that it is has been done in California for the last 15 years, I think. Some other states are beginning to pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
But here's something that's been around and makes the point I would make earlier about how you get innovation really going with countrywide. So next question is... I think really fundamental to the future, and where do you all see education and education, particularly in science and engineering, that will enable us to produce the skills that are needed to get us there? Why don't we start with you, Neil?
Yeah, I'm obviously it's essential. I mean, you look at all of the technology companies in clean tech, and you need highly trained professionals. You need highly trained engineers. You need highly trained scientists. You need a level of training that we do have available here in the States, but we need to protect. they come hand in hand.
I would simply add, our universities in recent years have more and more, the graduate schools especially, been filled with foreign students, and many of them, after they get their degrees, stay here and become entrepreneurs and the rest. And the way the visa systems are being run now, an awful lot of those people are being educated but then sent home immediately. I mean, they ought to be free to go wherever they want, but we're losing an awful lot of great intellectual capital by running our visa programs in such a way that it makes it really hard for some really able graduate of an American graduate school who's ready to start a new battery company or a new renewable fuels company or whatever to have to go back home to do it. Maybe he wants to go back home someday, but it'd be a good idea if we could have him stay here for a few years and start the company first.
Well, I'd like to also put in a plug for just basic education. And when I was in school, when I was in grammar school and high school in California, we were the top state in the country in education. Today, I believe we're something like 47th. You don't get top people in graduate school and in these programs and studying and coming up with innovative ideas if they couldn't get through high school, if they couldn't get through elementary school. You can't do it if you diminish the importance or the validity of science and the science curriculum in school. We need to have kids from the start understand, be excited about learning, and also have these opportunities for the future, something that they can be excited about from early on. We got recycling because of kids in elementary school who came home and told their folks, it's important that we recycle. We need the same kind of thing in all of these areas we're talking about. We need everybody working on it, and to the extent that these are newer ideas, innovative technologies that we want, they maybe are a good tool for exciting our young people again about education and about what they need to do in order to become the graduate students of the future, in order to become the innovators.
Okay, I got time for two more questions, and I apologize that I'm inundated with questions we haven't had time to ask. But I do want to ask one, which is, how do we feel about the role, future role of nuclear power? People in terms of alternative energy tend to rule that off into another place, but I think it's a really good and legitimate question. And how do we feel about it, particularly expanding it, I think, in America?
Well, I'll take a step first. In terms of emissions, of course, it's clean in CO2 terms, at least while it's operating. There's some CO2 emissions at other parts of the process, but it's reasonably clean, and that's what has given it its current boost. It's also extremely expensive. Rocky Mountain Institute has done some very good studies and collection of data on this, and a lot of the expenses are often not acknowledged by the industry up close. You cannot get insurance for a nuclear power plant, so the federal government has to do the insurance. The loan guarantees are going up toward 100%. It is very heavily subsidized, and it's quite expensive. But it is clean. I think in the United States, the issue of safety is we can deal with, and the issue of nuclear waste is a political problem. It's something we'd have to solve, but we could solve it. The real problem, I think, with nuclear power is that the companies that get involved in building light water reactors for the United States are going to want to get economies of scale and sell a lot of them, and that means they're going to want to sell them overseas. And if they're selling them in, say, Germany or Britain or so forth, fine. But more and more countries are wanting to get into the business of having nuclear reactors, and for some of them, it is a shortcut to having fissile material that they can make into a bomb. Because once you are in the fuel cycle, you're reprocessing plutonium or you're enriching uranium or both, and you have the right to do that under the international treaties that set things up. You may be constrained by the agreement like the U.S. and the UAE have an agreement which may constrain the UAE from getting into the fuel cycle. But the international treaties let you get into the fuel cycle, and once you're in the fuel cycle, with only a minor bit of deception or by withdrawing from the treaty relatively after as soon as you get done what you need to have done, you can get into the business of having nuclear weapons. North Korea has done it. Iran is in the process of doing it. So unless and until we come up with thorium, with fast converter reactors, with whatever, with different types of technologies that are much harder to develop nuclear weapons out of than the current light water reactors, I think that's their problem. And I think it is a very, very awesome and difficult and terrible problem.
Could I give you one?
Yep.
Just on the electricity side, as was mentioned this morning, we haven't built a nuclear power plant in 30 years. So in the United States, we have proposals for them right now. And so without looking necessarily to Amory to get his projections of costs or other things, without looking at decommissioning or any of those, Florida Power and Light, who is proposing to build a power plant, a nuclear power plant in Florida, is currently up to somewhere in the neighborhood of $8,000 a kilowatt. And that's just for the capital costs. That's not for any of the other costs. I've been working on renewable energy for 30-some years, and I'm always told renewables cost too much. There is not a renewable we're talking about that is in that cost range. Let us have a shot at what we can do with renewables and efficiency before you go to $8,000 or $9,000 a kilowatt-type power plants.
Okay. Last question. How would you alter or, I think, improve President Obama's plan for alternative energy and green tech, if at all? Do you want to? Why don't you start that?
Yeah, I think it is a fantastic start. There are changes around the edges that I think are being worked through and potentially could still come out of the plan. I think there's been, particularly in the biofuel industry, there's been what I believe is a bit of a rush to demonstration scale projects before the development of the technologies have been fully developed. You've had money that has been focused not on R&D, but large-scale projects. And I think actually shifting the focus a little bit more towards funding of R&D before demonstration will kind of get us around some of the ready, fire, aim syndrome that we're seeing now with some of the projects in the biofuels industry.
Jan?
The devil's always in the detail. It's the details of implementation that are going to make a big difference. And many of the things that we've talked about today, we're talking about small projects. We're talking about local activities. And we need to design these policies and programs in a way that allow, for instance, the Berkeley solar program to be replicated in other communities to allow aggregation of a lot of small projects. So it's all in, I think it's going to be in the detail of how these policies are implemented that's going to be the main area we need to work on and focus on.
In addition to the things already mentioned, one big one. Last Sunday, front page story in the New York Times about Chinese government-affiliated, almost certainly hackers, into the government communications of 100 different-plus countries. Malware, viruses, all of that. We have an electricity grid in the United States that used to be a bunch of small sort of local operations in terms of their control systems, but now that we're controlling them over the web with commercial off-the-shelf software, we know they are penetrated. We have a very serious grid security problem. People say they want to do demand response, and they want the utility to be able to go in and turn your air conditioning down in the summer. Well, if the utility can do that under our current grid, so can perhaps the Chinese, the Russians, Hezbollah, and maybe even eighth graders in Marin County if they're halfway decent hackers. The current firewalls probably keep out the third or fourth grade hackers, but the eighth graders are through there fast. All of the people who are talking about a smart grid, if I could have one thing, I would say, stop. Secure smart grid. Not just smart. Smart and able to be penetrated and operated by other people is really, really, really dumb.
Well, on that happy upper, I want to thank the audience. You have been terrific. Then I want to thank Jan and Neil and Jim for a most enlightening set of presentations and discussion. I want to remind you that we are going to have a short break, and then let's all reconvene in the grand ballroom when Les Gelb is going to be talking about just what we want to hear over lunch, U.S. strategic power in the 21st century. That's worthy of a lunch talk. Thank you very much for coming.
How are you?